A big eclipse, does it signal the end game for the USA? We're going to talk about it in podcast 797, the Bob Davis Podcasts. I'm going to start this podcast out by doing a commercial for myself for the Bob Davis Podcasts. Usually at the end of the podcast, I tell people where to get the podcasts and thanks a lot for this and thanks a lot for that. And when you do these as a tagline, which I write, you know, it just has the sound of just, it almost becomes wallpaper because you say it at the end of every podcast. It's like, hey, you know, you hear it on YouTube all the time. Hey guys, thanks for subscribing and sharing and hit the bell and do all this stuff. So I just want to let people know that the podcasts are available on a lot of different sources. One of the things I've been hearing a lot lately is GM having problems with Stitcher. If you are using an Android device, go to Spotify. Screw Stitcher. There's a lot of issues with Stitcher, and I don't know why, and I'm not trying to put them down. We are available at Stitcher.com. We are available at iTunes. We're available at TuneIn. If you have Alexa, Alexa uses TuneIn. We're on Google Play Music. Or Google Play is what I call it. I don't know about the app because I don't use the Google app for podcasts, but if you do, you should be able to get the podcasts on that as well. And I mention all these sources because you can also listen to the podcast right off the page at thebobdavispodcast.com, both from streaming. So when you pull the page up, if you click on the red box, there's streaming. You can turn that off. You can click on individual posts or the permalink, and you can listen to podcasts. You can also subscribe to the podcast by hitting subscribe on an individual podcast. There's also a subscribe button right on the page. See, there's all these tools and things like that. Spend some time on the Bob Davis Podcasts. And click some stuff, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Finally, when it comes to social media, you know, I appreciate the shares. Shares really help people build their audience. So if you are on Facebook, please share the podcast. If you like it, it does nothing for me. I appreciate the likes. But clicking on the podcast post is important, and sharing the podcast on your Facebook feed, if you like it, where you put it, you hit share, and then you say something. Hey, this is my favorite podcaster, Bob Davis. Boom, listen to this. That really helps me a lot. Also appreciate the donations for Mobile Podcast Command at thebobdavispodcast.com. Ed Nass sent me $40. Really appreciate that. And I also thanked everybody at the close of last year, and we'll do that again next year. So thanks for your contributions. What do you do if you're injured at work or play? Do you handle the insurance and workers' comp claims by yourself? Well, my suggestion is it would be a good idea to have someone like John D. Scott of Hoffman, Hamer & Associates handle your claims because it gets very complicated for individuals to do. John is a great personal injury lawyer. He's meticulous, and he has really helped people out. Here's his number. You might want to put this aside. 952-683-1351. 952-683-1351. Of course, the banner for JD. Injurylaw.com is always going to be there at thebobdavispodcast.com. So if you need them, you can click on it and just remember that. Yes, an accident comes without any warning, especially when you're having fun or when you're working because you're trying to get stuff done. The last story that John told me was about a client who was a truck driver, and he was unloading the truck, and the forklift guy was behind him and rolled in, and the blades of the forklift came down on top of his head. Now, he wasn't killed. He was severely injured. A huge crease in his head from this thing, and he does have some neck pain and some other issues. And John is working to get what for him is due him because these workman comp claims are complicated because usually they are fought by the companies for whatever reason. And you need an attorney who can meticulously go through these things and figure out how to get you what is coming to you and help you coordinate workers' comp, auto insurance benefits, all those things when you are hurt for whatever reason. So once again, John D. Scott of Hoffman, Hamer & Associates. Here's his number, 952-683-1351, 952-683-1351, John Scott of Hoffman, Hamer & Associates. Here's my takeaway from the big federal government shutdown, which, as I have pointed out and which everyone else has pointed out, is only about 30% of the federal government is shut down, and everyone is freaking out about the potential effects. My takeaway was the interesting coverage of how this is going to hurt the economy and all the people that are having to go and get loans, bridge loans to survive, and they've only missed one paycheck, which tells you a lot about the financial state of even people who work for the federal government, probably the most secure jobs of all the jobs in the world. And this is not to say us versus them. But what I've learned from this shutdown is how much the federal government is deeply involved with every aspect of our lives at the state and federal level. In my state, the federal government is, I think, the fourth largest employer in the state. And one of the things all of us have noticed in Minnesota, and particularly in Minneapolis and St. Paul area, and I don't know if it's people who have left town because it's cold, because in January, snowbirds leave. But I don't think that I have noticed traffic as loose as it is right now, especially at drive times. And I noticed it the other day because I have a networking meeting that starts at 7 a.m. about 20 miles from my house. And so I get on the road and usually I leave at 6:10 or so, 6:15, sometimes a little bit later at 6:30. And I've noticed that there is very little traffic on the road. And it was enough that I was like, what's going on? Is it Sunday? Is it Saturday morning? What's going on here? And then I was like, oh, that's right. So, and I brought this up with other people and they've said they've noticed the same thing. And it's anecdotal, but I think what's interesting here is not to bust on the federal workers. It's not to say how dare they. You know, my bank teller said to me the other day, I feel sorry for them. And I said, I don't feel sorry for them because they have very secure jobs. They're going to get back pay when this thing is over with, and it will eventually end. But this is what's interesting. The focus of the coverage is on the fruit of the federal government. In other words, all we hear about is the things that aren't going to be done and the amount of money that commerce will lose because just 30% of the federal government is shut down. And everyone else is focused on all the little details, the political details of the shutdown. When is it going to end? You know, what this one said today versus what that one said, what this one did today versus what that one did today, and how that's going to affect negotiations and everything else. I don't know when the shutdown is going to end. I don't know when the deal is going to be made that ends the shutdown. I don't know what deal will be made that would end the shutdown. I wouldn't want to speculate on that. I think the most significant thing about this whole thing is that we focused consistently in reporting on how deeply the federal government is spread out in terms of resources in all 50 states, so that when the federal government collapses, let's say, or is shut down, all 50 states feel the pain, some more than others, and some more than others depending on what kinds of services they have. Most people in my state really don't realize that the federal government is the largest employer in the state, whether it's the IRS or the Veterans Administration or some other part of the federal government. In most states, the federal government is an important employer, very few, and some states more than others, depending on what's there. And of course, depending on whether it's defense or whether it is something that's considered quote unquote essential, the impact is greater. You know, with a certain generation of Americans and with a certain persuasion politically or philosophically speaking, the implication would be we should be concerned about that because that shows you how big the state is. But most people don't see that. And, we have a big eclipse in podcast time. We're just on the very edge and the sort of the pre-eclipse moments. This thing happens at 8:36 p.m. Central my time, and it is daytime. So, you know, we're sort of in the pre-eclipse energy. And eclipses are a great opportunity to sort of use them as waypoints and say, okay, we have an eclipse. This is a big thing energetically, and all the New Age people are talking about it. All the astrologers are talking about it. You know, everybody, all the – and what I find fascinating is that, you know, the religious people generally reject – the metaphysical movement, and yet they are all throwing up videos on YouTube and posts about this super blood wolf moon. You know, we have to give it a name because then it has a consciousness. If it has a name, that is going down, and what it means in terms of either prophecy or what it means in terms of energy. And I'm fascinated with eclipses because they're really cool to watch. And this one, of course, the moon will turn orange, not really red. It will turn orange because of the fact that the Earth is passing in front of the moon and the sun is, you know, going around it, even though it's night when we see it here in North America. And most of North America, with the exception of the far western states, and just as on a line and sort of coming down, the poor viewing capabilities on a line west of Minneapolis and St. Paul all the way out to the West Coast and most of the Southwest. But if you're in the East or in the Midwest, you should have been able to see this eclipse beautifully. So it's a great opportunity to take a moment and take a breath and talk about what's actually happening out there. So this is for the so-called conservatives whose champion is Donald Trump. And the people that said, you know, it's better than Hillary and he's our guy and we're going to support our guy no matter what. And, you know, we've got to fight for American values, which means our perception of American values. And I want to talk about what I think is beginning to happen in the world and what I think is beginning to happen in the United States in terms of those values and in terms of what the younger people value and what they think is important, without making too many judgments. But one of the things that I see is people don't necessarily subscribe to the theory anymore that debt and deficits are bad. They seem to subscribe to the theory that if your country can print its own currency, then you can print as much currency as you want, and you can endure any amount of inflation. And more than likely, you won't endure any inflation to provide benefits to the people as a whole. Which, what does it do? It makes the federal government more powerful. It makes government itself bigger because government is the body that's spending the money. And if you borrow and spend, there's no sunset because modern monetary theory basically says that acquiring more debt, there's no set end to it, and it's essentially free money. And yes, even the modern monetary monetarists, so to speak, or the theory, the people that back MMT, do agree that at some point there could be a potential end game in terms of inflation being incurred as a result of printing too much currency. But in terms of providing benefits, they don't see any problem with it. Of course, this is one of the things that happened with Rome. It happens to all societies that figure out if they debase the currency, then they can have more things, that the government can do more things and people are mollified. And in Rome's case, they started to debase the currency literally by removing most of the heavy metal from it, most of the silver or gold, until eventually it was just some kind of metal. And then they started putting holes in the money. I don't remember what the application of that was. People who study ancient economics should, but they had no idea. They just needed more coins for the realm. They didn't realize that they were inflating their currency. And there is a theory also that as you print more money and as the money is worth less and less, no matter what you get, it also creates a sort of mania in society. And there are societal implications in terms of morality, societal implications in terms of behavior, which is kind of a suppressed theory. It's kind of not talked about very much. But it does explain a lot of the strange behavior in this country to a certain extent, is that people don't realize that the dollar is now worth less than 1/25th of what it was once worth back in just 1960. So when you think of the 1960s and you think of the visuals of the 1960s or the 1950s, people earned less money, but a dollar went further. So if you had $100,000, that would be like having what? Almost $2 million today. So think of that in terms of value. If somebody walked up and handed you $1.2 million, what would you do? Then the number was 10,000 or 100,000. And today, so for example, the movie Psycho, the protagonist in the movie Well, I don't know if it's the protagonist, but yeah, she's the protagonist, the character, the young woman who steals the money. She stole $10,000. So you think to yourself today, well, why would someone steal $10,000? It doesn't seem to make sense. You know, it's not going to get you very far. Well, then that's something you could almost retire on, $10,000 back in 1960. So it meant, so when people heard the term $10,000, that they thought, wow, that's an awful lot of money. That's a lot of money. That's what inflation has done to the country. And I personally am old enough to remember the inflation of the 1970s and the effect it had on people and the panic that ensued. Now, we don't have inflation today. You know, we have low inflation, or 1.5 to 2% inflation. But here's the thing: if the economy is growing at 2.5% and inflation is at 2.5%, are you gaining any ground? So if you look and you say, well, we have 4% GDP growth and we should be happy. This is back in the first quarter or the second quarter of 2018, right? Oh, things are going great. Okay. But if inflation is at 2.5% or 2%, then that eats up 2% of the GDP, in my view. Now, maybe that's not economically correct, but you really don't have 4% GDP when you have 2% inflation. So stable currencies are very important, and you can't have a stable currency if you keep printing what they call fiat currency. And this is the Federal Reserve by fiat basically saying, we're just going to inject money. Now, they don't print the money at the Fed. The Mint prints the money. But what the Fed does is inject money electronically into the banking system and press money out into the economy through the different levers that the Fed has, the discount window, the money they give to the banks, and so forth and so on. And the idea is that the banks then loan this money out, and that's what happens. The modern monetary theorists believe that you just inject more and more money into the economy to cover the debt, and you don't have to worry about it, and you can have universal health care, and you can have people taken care of, and you can have minimum incomes, and you can have all these wonderful things. And why not? Because we should be taking care of people. I think this is the prevalent view. This is the prevailing view, I should say, of people in this country. I don't care where it comes from. I don't care if it's credit cards. I don't care if it's, you know, whatever. In terms of resources and in terms of success, What is the prevailing view of success? It's having things. It's having a new car. It's having the nice trailer. It's having the SUV. It's having the RV. It's having the big house. It's having these things. And what do people do? They borrow. And some people manage debt their entire lives. They don't even think about it. They're borrowing constantly, and they have all these wonderful things. And in a second, in the second half of this podcast, I want to talk about what that means in terms of business and what it means in terms of our society and how we function in this society. So what's your greatest resource as a company? It's probably the time that you spend on your company, running your company, and the time that your employees spend. And one of the things that really helps maximize that resource is having a payment processor that you can work with. And so I want to talk about the payment processing revolution in this country. This is the idea that, you know, it used to be that people, if you wanted to pay with a credit card, you had to go through the scanner. If you wanted to pay with a check, you had to write a check, and then you had to wait for the person to send you the check, and if they didn't send the check, you had to call them, and so forth and so on. Payment processing solves all of that. Now, I'm working with a company called ReliaFund at ReliaFund.com, ReliaFund.com. I have a ReliaFund button on my site so that people can pay me through checks if they want to, and these guys are great because you get paid faster and business is booked faster, and it's a great thing to be able to have a great payment processor. So one of the things ReliaFund also does, they don't have a set way of handling things. They can integrate what they're doing into any payment system that you have, into any software that you have. They will work with your developers to get this thing done and to come up with a payment processing solution that works for you, even if it is custom fitted. So this is what ReliaFund does. They have been providing integrated solutions to get payments cleared for more than 2 decades. No long-term contracts, secure, technology-focused. Here's their number, 866-243-5040, 866-243-5040. You will talk to a human being. Ask for Kevin Hill or Greg Lowry. Check them out online at ReliaFund.com. That's ReliaFund.com. So if you're manufacturing, you're probably looking for an American manufacturer because of these issues with tariffs. And there's a lot of confusion about what's going to happen with all of this trade stuff going on. It's in the news. And so if you're looking for a great American manufacturer, I can recommend DepoStar, D-E-P-O-T, DepoStar American Design Engineering and Manufacturing. Visit them online at DepoStar.com, D-E-P-O-T-S-T-A-R, DepoStar.com. Where this leads is this. If you have the capacity, let's say that you're starting a business and you have the capacity to borrow money. So you start your business and you have a business plan and you go find your friendly local banker and you borrow $100,000, which isn't that much money. And you, by today's standards, and you use that money to start your business. You're borrowing money to start your business and you're going to continue to borrow money as you go. So without – I don't know as much about business as I know about other things, but I can tell you that you use credit as a gap. So if you're buying a lot of capital equipment, you have to have credit because occasionally you got to – the machines that you're buying are too expensive to pay cash for. So what you do is you borrow the money, buy the machines, but the machines have to produce income. So if you're starting a business and your resource is you, then borrowing money means you have to figure out how you're going to pay that money back, and you have to actually be the machine that produces the profit so that you can add up all of the expenses at the end of the month and say, okay, the borrowing the money has helped me grow my business. But I think a lot of people just figure, oh, this is how you start a business. You borrow a lot of money and you grow the business. And that's not completely out of the range of expectation, because there's a lot of businesses out there that provide services and they borrow money to do exactly what I just talked about, build equipment and, you know, servers, drill for oil or whatever on a grand scale. But you have to actually be producing assets as a business to be successful. There has to be an asset flow into the coffers of the business for you to be able to borrow money. And the idea is that with borrowing money by printing money, well, that's a different thing entirely. And I don't think people really understand that you're basically pushing inflation to have more cash to be able to provide services. And younger people today especially, they want those services. And they think those services are a human right. So you have the human right to medical care. You have the human right to have a certain dignity, a certain level of income that gives you dignity. And so we have all of these government services that are funded by this fiat currency, basically, that can be expanded or have already been expanded to provide people with the basics. And so when that gets shut down, then people start saying, well, I can't get my food stamps and I can't get this and I can't get that. And then you start to see where the people are that are dependent on it and what they're doing. And what the younger people today want to do is expand this, because they believe this is a value. This is an American value. We let everybody in. We help people because that's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to help people who are less fortunate than we are. We are our brother's keeper. And for people who are quote unquote conservatives, they think that this is not an American value. But I am asserting these are the new American values. And let me go further. So the other thing is that the new American values that are beginning to emerge are globalization. And I don't mean free trade. I mean literally one earth government, a global confederation of governments that would end war, that would end competition, that would end this constant struggling, because the government would exist as a system for redistributing income and providing people who have less with more. And thus, statism, the state becomes the supreme factor in almost every consideration. Why do I say this? Well, I'm just going to talk about my state. In Minnesota, when you look at the top employers in the state, you have to go three or four down before you even get to a private company, and that would be Target. So it's fourth or fifth. The largest employer in the state is the Mayo Clinic, which is a public-private partnership. The second largest employer in the state, I believe, is either the state or the University of Minnesota and all its subsidiaries, or it is the federal government. And then you get to Target, and then you get to companies like United Health and so forth. Medica, United Health, and so forth, which are also funded through what? Through federal health insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, and so forth, and all of their subsidiaries that are making money are funded in the same way. So the government has a big role in all of these agencies, and agencies of the federal government in particular, but then the state government are a huge number. They have a huge number of employees in almost every state and a huge number of employees in this state. And so if you decide you're going to cut the budget, then people are going to be out of work and you're going to be thrown out of office in a very short period of time, because people don't live on a cash basis anymore. The average person has $400 or $500 in their bank account, but they might have access to $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 worth of credit, and that's what they live off of. And so they pay their credit card bills when they can, and when they run out of money, they use credit cards. And so the average person doesn't live in the way that they're on a cash basis. One of the most exciting things that you can do as a person is to decide to live on a cash basis. Suddenly, you realize the power of the dollar, and you realize how important it is not to spend money. I have been living on a cash basis for a long time, and as I have often said in other podcasts, I've learned how to get by with very little because I don't want to spend the money. I'd rather keep my money than spend it. But if I was living off of credit cards, and when I was living off of credit cards, we'd go out on a Friday night and decide to buy a TV. And it didn't matter how much, we have to get a new TV. So we'd just go to the store and get a new TV. And nobody even bothered to think about, what it was going to cost. And so we paid top dollar for stuff. And of course, if you add up the interest rates and the time payments of things, we probably paid, $1,500 for that television, at least, if not more, because we financed it. And that's true with cars and everything else. I would rather drive a $1,200 car and fix it every now and then go out and buy a brand new car for $80,000. What's the point? And this is the whole thing with people that my business has to look right. I have to have a brand new truck. So if you go out and you buy yourself a new Toyota Tundra or, a Chevy pickup truck or a Ford pickup truck with all the things on it that are in, the BMW. So, all the extras, it's $75,000-$80,000. And what do people do? They finance it for 64 months, and I suppose if you need a truck, then you need a truck. But the point is, you financed it, and so you're carrying that debt. And what happens is all of that debt and all of that spending increases the power of the state. So the state today is much more supreme in terms of sovereignty than the individual, even though we are supposedly guaranteed sovereignty as citizens of the United States. At least that's what all the founding documents say, that the individual is supreme. But what has happened monetarily is that the state has become supreme because we can't – it's too big to fail. We can't let it fail, because if it fails, it will cause a depression on a scale that we have never seen. So despite all the protests of the so-called conservatives, and yet here we have a conservative president who has shut down the government because Congress won't give him $5 billion. It would have to borrow on an already $4 trillion plus budget that he increased in order to what? In order to, quote unquote, build a wall to address a political issue that his supporters want to have addressed. I'm not passing judgment on the wall, positive or negative. It's borrowed money. So what that does is that allows somebody to come in and say, well, if we're going to spend $4 trillion a year and we're going to spend $5 billion building a wall, why can't we spend $5 billion to extend health care to people who don't have it? And the answer is, I don't have an answer. Because if I'm going to support the wall, then I guess I have to support deficit spending for you to do what you want to do. Why can't we have deficit spending to give people a minimum income? Which is basically the minimum income idea is an idea that's kind of a libertarian idea based on a consumer tax and an elimination of all welfare programs and a creation of something called a minimum income that would be derived from consumer taxes and would be derived because we would eliminate all of the other welfare programs. Well, what you're hearing now is we want to have a minimum income without getting rid of all these other programs. So if you are going to go spend $4 billion or $5 billion to do something that I want to do, then you should support spending $5 billion or more to do what I want to do. because I think this is an important goal and I have a lot of political support for it. So there's no real controls in terms of spending despite the protests. So what's going to happen with this? This is where you start to get into predicting the future. People are going to have to learn the lesson that our grandparents and great-grandparents learned during the Depression in the 1930s. And I would suggest that everybody listening read The Forgotten Man by Amity Schley. Schley's, who did an excellent job looking at the results of the programs enacted during the Depression when they really didn't know what they were doing. The Depression probably originally caused by an overreaction by the Federal Reserve. And what is the Federal Reserve? It's an unelected council of suzerains who decide what to do with the money. And now that the money is worth nothing, in other words, it's based on nothing, it's literally paper, they can print as much as they want of it, or they can inject as much as they want of funny money, literally fake money, and the mint can print as much paper as it wants to. So the mint, the actual dollar, is not a silver certificate or based on gold. It's based on nothing. And so when somebody injects $5 billion more in the economy to pay for something that somebody wants, because that's what it means, who cares if the government is $25 trillion in debt? So our debt basically equals our GDP output, a great deal of which is actually government spending. That's the situation that we're in. And people don't realize the danger that means, because they think that there's no end to this. And this is, I think that this is an end stage perception, and it's very interesting to me how many academics and so-called experts jump on the bandwagon, because it's almost an end game perception that only happens at the end of manias, where people are like, well, it doesn't matter. If you borrow money to buy stocks, it's free money. That's what happened in the Depression, margin buying, right? So when stocks inexplicably went down in 1929, people were ruined because they had – not only had they bought stocks that were worthless, they had borrowed the money to buy stocks that were worthless, and now their fortune was at risk. So they were literally at the poker table borrowing money from the house to play, and when they lost, which they inevitably would, they didn't think they would lose, but when they did, well, then they had to go back to the house and pay them back. And so people were ruined, and that's why they jumped out of windows, because they didn't know what else was going on. We're a little bit different situation, but we're in this sort of mania where people seem to think that there's no end to this, that we can borrow and spend. And I don't know how long it goes on, to tell you the truth. I don't think people understand that you have to be producing and you have to have real value if you want real resources. So borrowing to buy cars and trucks and clothes and go to the best schools and have this standard of living is one of the reasons people who make six figures or more, and who, by the way, are in the top 5% of earners, are literally bankrupt at any one moment. They are $500 from bankruptcy, because everything is a credit, and the house is credit and the cars are credit. And the last time we saw that was in 2008, when people that you wouldn't expect were literally turned out, or they were living in their house and not paying their mortgages. I know people who were knocking on doors at that time, in politics, and I was told that there were people in tears because they didn't know what to do because they hadn't paid their mortgage in 6 months. And I'm sure many of those are out. And if you follow the mortgage market, in some markets, there are still places where people aren't paying their mortgages. So when this is over, in other words, when we actually are in the final moments of the end game and no one knows how long it will last, we will have a different world when it's over, because the values of the younger people and many people who are older won't be here when that comes. Their values are very collectivist. Their values are the state. Their values, they don't value sovereignty as individuals because they don't think they need it. They don't understand that the power of the state, once power is centered in the state, and I don't care if you're a left-wing person or if you're a right-wing person, once that happens, then the state has enough power to suppress any rebellion. And people look at these things like Brexit and the Paris rebellion, and they think, "Oh, this is the people. This is populism. This is the people overthrowing the state." Eventually, what will happen in Paris will be what happened in Tiananmen Square. They will put this down with – they have the power of the military. They will use the military, and they will put this revolution down or whatever you want to call it, this, and I'm not saying it's good, the yellow jacket thing, they will put those people down with extreme prejudice, as they will do in this country eventually. And eventually, right now, we're sort of skewing out to the radical side on the right, even though the president is not a conservative. He's a populist. That's going to be pulled back in, and I think it's going to be pulled back in relatively quickly. And when this whole thing is over, there will be a different view of the world. I do believe that future generations, one or two down, we will not be a free country. I don't think we're really a free country now. And we will not be able to say anything we want, which we can't now. And we will not have control of our currency, which we don't now. And eventually, we won't have control of our person. Someone else will. And they will use technology, and they will use whatever they can use and all the power they have to prevent people from stepping out of bounds. And eventually, what they'll do is they'll use the push, you know, the nudge sort of processes with the power they have to force people to obey the law, voluntarily. And so the word freedom will mean something completely different than what it means today. And I think that's where we're at. And we'll see what happens. But I think the hardest part for people is going to see what happens when you spend and borrow, and the debt reaches the point where it's unmanageable, and you have a situation where the government starts to print more money to address the problem, and you have an economic problem. Finally, one more point. So all of this government and all of these intrusions into markets, if you think of the economy as a force of nature, meaning almost a Borg, the human experience of making hundreds and hundreds of decisions a day on what you're going to do. Am I going to go to the store or record a podcast first? Am I going to buy a new car or buy a used car? So billions of people, hundreds of millions of people in this country making hundreds of millions of decisions an hour about what they're going to do. When you start inserting the government in those decision-making processes, how much you're going to get paid, how much the government's going to give you, how much you pay for insurance, how much you pay for this, how much you pay for that, you know, what your tax bills are locally, and I mean county, local, state, federal, and what the expense for things is in terms of regulation and rules like minimum wage and so forth. When that stuff is done, when the government steps in and starts inserting stops and pulls and everything else in this system to try to control this force of nature, then you start to get pooling. You start to get scarcities, and you start to get higher prices, and the economy starts to falter because you're interrupting the natural processes in this force of nature. You can't contain a thunderstorm. The thunderstorm kind of just has to run its course, and the economy is the same thing. In the interest of easing the pain of individuals, we have inserted all these stopgap measures, and we have inserted the government into all of the processes of life, and we have made all these rules to hopefully make people better, and we have licensed, and we have all kinds of procedures that are required so that nothing bad ever happens. And as a result, you start to get these problems that develop in society. So if you shut just 30% of the government down, people start freaking out because then they realize what's going to happen to the future. And I think this is the future. I mean, I think this is it. And I think it's going to – this collectivism is going to grow. And I think people are going to support it. I think they agree with it. I think they believe in it. And I think that if you're a libertarian, if you're a Republican, and Republicans aren't necessarily libertarians, they're just as much collectivist as any Democrat. They just don't know it. I think they're going to be really surprised to find out that public opinion isn't on their side. We will find out. But I think this is the beginning of the end game for the USA. Well, with all of this stuff going on, it's good to know that there is something that makes me happy. You know why? Because I hate my printer. I hate my printer because I don't like paying maximum price from the big box retailers for something as simple as a print cartridge. So let me introduce to you Cartridge World in Maple Grove. They can save you, get ready, 30% compared to the big box stores. Those cartridges, especially for my printer, are ridiculous, and it's highway robbery. And I am so glad, because every time I get a cartridge from Cartridge World, I am sticking it to the man. And of course, the best thing is Cartridge World cartridges are guaranteed to perform as good as new. I think they're better than new, personally. Free delivery on qualifying orders. Cartridge World in Maple Grove off of Weaver Lake Road between Dairy Queen and Subway. If you're listening to this podcast all over the country or world, they can hook you up. Cartridge World, 763-420-6632, 763-420-6632, or you can click on the Cartridge World banner at the top of the page at thebobdavispodcasts.com. Well, there you go. Thanks again for listening to the Bob Davis Podcast online and in all these different places, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Facebook and Twitter and everything else. Appreciate you favoriting and loving and all that stuff. See, it's so good to know there's at least one good thing in the world, or two if you include Cartridge World. Thanks for listening to Podcast 797, the Bob Davis Podcasts. Bye-bye.
I take two.